Welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. For years, we've been told that stress is simply the price of success. But our guest today, leadership advisor and workplace researcher Amy Leneker, says that assumption may be seriously misguided. Drawing on findings from her recent national study, The State of Stress and Joy at Work, she's been examining how stress is reshaping careers, redefining effective leadership, and changing workplace culture across the country.
In her new book, Cheers to Monday, The Surprisingly Simple Method to Lead and Live with Less Stress and More Joy, Amy explores why joy may actually be one of the most overlooked drivers of performance and what individuals and leaders can do about it.
Amy Leneker joins us now. Amy, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to see you both.
You too. All right. If stress were really the key to success, we would all be wildly successful right now. What's the biggest myth about stress that your research challenges?
Thank you for saying that, because I think it is the biggest myth that stress is the price we have to pay for success. And it simply isn't. And I think intuitively we know that, anecdotally we know that, but now we actually have data to back it up that shows the more stressed you are, actually the least successful you feel. And so it's really about flipping this conversation on its head and saying, what role does stress play and what role should it no longer play in our lives?
Sure. How did you go about your study? We know that we're coming up on the International Day of Happiness on March 20th, a day when the whole world should be aware of the importance and state of happiness. But how did you drive your study to find out more about this?
Thank you. So what I did, well, first I lived everything you shouldn't do. So I started with how not to do it by burning out twice. Then I spent several years doing interviews and focus groups with leaders and teams across industries. And then we did a national study to find out what is happening in working America right now. So combining the qualitative data, the quantitative data, and my own experience was how I was able to put out that latest study report.
Amy, I'm wondering, as you conducted all these interviews and you've made this your life's work now, What is the personality profile of the person who just doesn't accept stress? Because we have all seen them. What's going on in their head? What's going on in their body?
It's an interesting question because I don't believe that there's anyone who doesn't have stress. When we look at what the definition of stress is, the physiological response to change, there isn't a way to go through the world without stress. There isn't a way to go through the day without stress. The problem, though, is many people don't understand the different types of stress. So there is good stress and there's the not so good kind. So it's impossible to go through life without stress, but it is possible to go through it with the least amount of the distressing kind as possible. So to answer your question, the profile is usually someone who doesn't fully understand what stress is or how it shows up in their lives.
Right. You come up with some interesting statistics, American workers reporting that due to work stress, and I think we've all been here, 63% have considered leaving their career. I've been there on at work that I love to do when I'm feeling stress. That's when these weird thoughts enter into our minds, like, I'm just going to quit this job. I'm going to leave this career. What other kinds of strange and really irrational types of thinking enter into our brains?
And I do want to add that maybe it's not strange or rational at all, that if you are feeling high levels of stress every day, that maybe considering leaving that job is the most rational thought you're going to have. So many times when I work with leaders, they start from exactly the place that you just shared. I'm having this random thought of just quitting tomorrow and having to unpack that and say, well, what is the impact of staying? And can you be successful in this role if you stay? And the stat that you just mentioned is one that troubled me a lot, because what this is telling us is that stress isn't just a problem today. This is a leadership problem for tomorrow. So if we don't figure this out, we are not going to have the leadership pipeline that we need for the future.
Your research suggests that joy at work is not frivolous. It's actually functional. What happens inside the brain or the workplace when joy disappears?
What happens, unfortunately, is what we're seeing now. So we see that engagement goes down. We see that trust goes down. We see that performance goes down. So joy is actually a performance enhancer. We know from neuroscience that when we're experiencing joy, we're more creative. We actually think more clearly and we make better decisions. So when I'm sitting down, and this just happened a few weeks ago, with the CEO who said, with all due respect, I'm not that interested in joy. Can I push back on that just a little? Because what if I said I could help your organization think more clearly and make better decisions and be more engaged? Would you be interested in that? So it's this complete myth that we have about the role that joy plays and the role that stress plays.
Oh, that makes so much sense to me, but
I
am not a CEO of a big company. You've been working as a consultant and in large company leadership for a long time. Mm-hmm. Have you noticed a trajectory with the relationship between joy in the workplace and stress? Has it changed?
Thank you. I have seen it. And what I have been seeing anecdotally was a real generational shift in stress and joy. And so when we did the national study to show that the data back it up, so what we're finding is that, and what the study found, is that younger generation, so Gen Z, faces more work stress than any other generation. And what's really interesting about that is not only do they feel it more frequently, they also feel it more negatively than any other generation. So we've got this big disconnect right now in organizations between what Gen Z is saying, I'm willing to accept this amount of stress in my life. Here's my expectation of joy at work. And it is completely contrasting with the environment that they're getting when they show up every day.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that Gen Z is... I'm thinking of older people and how they so often say, oh, these kids, they don't want to work. They're lazy, or we worked so much harder. We had a better work ethic. Is this possibly a generational trope, or what is it about Gen Z that is perhaps allowing them to look at their workplace in a different lens?
I think it's possibly all of those factors. And before we hit record, we were talking about our shared Midwestern background. And I can't count the number of times I heard growing up, well, it's called work for a reason. It's not supposed to be fun. Well, maybe it's okay if it's a little fun. Maybe it's okay if it's a little bit joyful. So I think Gen Z is really, and again, just from the data, all I can share is that they are feeling it more strongly. They're feeling it more often. And I have to believe that part of it is them looking forward and saying, this may not be the life that I want. I don't want to have this much stress in my world every single day.
Yeah. Amy, when we look at other cultures, maybe if we look at other European cultures, because they're most closely connected to us in terms of how we go through life, but they always marvel at how much we work and how much stress there is and don't understand why we do what we do. And maybe if we look at those European cultures, there's some parallel now to Gen Z, you know, kind of the way that we're approaching things. What are some lessons that we can learn from those cultures about that you have seen during this time that you've been researching?
I think it comes down to what I call our stress stories. So every one of us has a stress story. And these are messages that we've been told directly or indirectly about what stress is, how it's supposed to feel, how much we should tolerate. And unless we pause to ask ourselves, is this story serving me? Is this giving me the life that I want? Then we tend to recreate that story. And that's what happened to me. That's how I burned out twice, was I was living out a stress story that I never intentionally chose. It was just the stress story of what I believed stress was. So I think in other cultures and other organizations and other places, the stress stories are different. And what we pass on about what stress should look like is different. And so it can really start with us. We can start with our own belief about what stress is, and is this giving me the life that's really going to allow me to look back on it and feel good about it?
The title of your book, Cheers to Monday. No doubt you're looking at this as a way to, you know, welcome Monday instead of have that nagging sense of dread. And I suspect that now the way you're living your life and approaching your career, you do say cheers to Monday. I do. I love what I do. But again, like Mary Beth said, I'm not the CEO of a Fortune 500 company either. But probably plenty of those people also say cheers to Monday. What's kind of a current, a running theme through those people who can feel good about Monday?
I think it's about being able to not dread Sunday night. When I work with leaders and teams, what I want to know about, I want to know how you feel Monday morning and how you feel Sunday night, because that's the mood that doesn't lie. And in my life, there was one instance where I had a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad boss, made my life just awful. And it wasn't just Monday morning, it was Sunday afternoon. I would start to get this pit in my stomach, like, gosh, am I really going back tomorrow? And then my life really just became a countdown. It was a countdown to get to Friday so I'd have a little bit of relief, and then the cycle started all over again on Sunday or Monday. So that was why I titled the book What I Did, because life shouldn't be a countdown to the weekend. It should be something that we can celebrate and enjoy every day.
A lot of people, especially in a place like Park City, that we run on a slightly different schedule than maybe the corporate workforce does, a lot of people are self-employed. If your villain in your life isn't perhaps a misguided boss or an overly structured workplace or something, if you're working for yourself, but you're not finding as much joy, do you have any recommendations for how people can infuse their work life with more joy?
I do. And I think in some ways it's harder because then we have to look in the mirror. And for me, I was my own worst enemy for years. The expectations that I put on myself were so much more than what the outside world was putting on me. So whether you work for a boss or whether you're self-employed or whether you're retired, joy is still the same three factors. So we can come back to what those three things are. So the first one is meaning. Do I feel meaning? Do I feel purpose? And every day should start with that. And some days it's harder than others, but to come back to what is my meaning? What is my purpose? We know the second driver of joy is mattering. When we matter in our relationships, are you spending time with people that leave you feeling good? Or are you spending time with people that leave you feeling drained and exhausted? And then the third piece, and this is the one that surprised me from the research. So the first two I expected, I had no shock at all that meaning and mattering showed up. But the third driver of joy was momentum. When I feel that there's momentum or progress. And so the more I started thinking about it, I thought about our son, who actually lives in Utah right now, going to college there. And he took up golf and he's obsessed with it. And I thought, oh, there's the momentum piece. Like just that belief of I am getting a little bit better. I am making some progress. So if we can just come back to meaning, mattering, and momentum, those are going to create the environment we need to tap into joy.
Yeah, those seem like they would work in a lot of categories of life.
Yes. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Amy Lenaker, author of a new book called Cheers to Monday, The Surprisingly Simple Method to Lead and Live with Less Stress and More Joy. What is the heart of this surprisingly simple method? We all want to know.
The heart of it is we have been overcomplicating stress at work. And one of the most heartbreaking things that I found in the interviews and focus groups that I did was that so much of what we try to do at work to make stress better actually makes it worse. So you've got well-intentioned leaders, well-intentioned organizations trying to improve things, and they're actually making it worse. So the surprisingly simple method is we can take three steps. We can see it, sort it, and solve it in a new way that eliminates overthinking, eliminates analysis paralysis, and allows us to keep moving forward.
It's interesting when you said that, Amy, my first thought went to team building and how well-intentioned leaders organize these team building things that might take a half a day or a whole day. Meanwhile, most of the people showing up, the members of the team, are stressing out even more because they're taking a half or a whole day to do this when they've got their plate full. I see you shaking your head. Yes, 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 yes. So that would be one example. What are some others?
It is an example, but only if it's not done well. So So I say that as someone who facilitates executive leadership offsites all the time. And I start each one by saying what you just said. This is an expensive room. It costs a lot to be here in terms of time and energy. You can either walk out of here feeling transformed, like you could not do the work you're going to do unless we spent this day together, or you're going to walk out feeling like it was a waste of time. And you're going to get to choose what that looks like. So if we can get leaders and teams to come into a space where they can shut out the outside world and transform the way they work together, it can have a ripple effect in the positive direction. But if you just bring people together for the sake of bringing them together, now their email just stacked up while they sat with you for 4 hours. So yes, that's absolutely one example. Another example that we do is many times we use shame and blame around stress. We do employee trainings or we bring in yoga on Fridays as if people can self-care their way out of a toxic work environment, and they can't. If I'm being bullied at work, all the yoga in the world is not going to make that better. One other quick example, and this just happened recently with a woman who shared with her leader that she was burnout, exhausted, couldn't do it anymore. So the leader, very well-intentioned, decided, I'm going to take some things off of her plate. That's what a good leader does, right? My employee's overwhelmed. I'm going to take things off their plate. Except what he took off was the project she cared most about, the project that actually brought her some joy. So now they had to have this whole conversation about how does she get back in the project? And so again, just one example of dozens of examples of how well-intentioned strategies end up making things worse.
Yeah. For that person who did get joy from this project, I'm wondering, you know, I've been in positions before where I'm not in love with what I'm doing, but someone will just mention a little tidbit of, gosh, why the work that we are doing matters so much. And it really would bring me out of the doldrums, you know, and get me back into this momentum that you're talking about. How do we recognize those little bits of joy? What are the questions we ask ourselves?
It could be as simple as, what's bringing you meaning? Because what you're describing is meaning. That little spark of joy is because you are connecting yourself to something bigger. I also think an incredibly powerful question is, what's bringing you joy at work right now? And if you ask a direct report that question and they don't have an answer, you just got some really important data. So if we go back to that leader, if that had been a regular conversation and the leader had been saying, what brings you joy? That woman would have said, oh, this project. And what's so ironic is the project had very little to do with her job description. So it made perfect sense that it was taken off of her plate, but it was tied up directly to her values. So if they had been having this regular conversation about what brings you joy, it would have never been on the table. That project would have been protected above anything else. I do want to add that if you're going to ask that question, you have to have enough trust that they're going to tell you the truth. When I think back to that horrible leader, if they had asked me what brings me joy, I would have said, oh, working for you. This is the most, I've never felt more joy. You're the single greatest leader I've ever had. And then I would have cried in therapy about how hard my job was. So you've got to build enough trust in order for people to really tell you the truth.
Well, speaking of that trust, a feeling of safety, of job security, of autonomy, there are elements that everybody finds important, or some find more important than others. Are there certain elements in the workplace that are kind of prerequisites to finding its best joy?
I think psychological safety is absolutely a prerequisite. And when we look at Dr. Amy Edmondson's work on psychological safety, it's the foundation of everything. That if I can't go to work and know that I can share my ideas or share my opinions without the fear of judgment, without the fear of repercussions, then it's impossible to do almost anything else. So when we look at the drivers of joy and what joy feels like, it's really hard to do those in a place where you do not feel psychologically safe or physically safe. One of the really striking things to me about our study was we found that 25% of working Americans say they feel bullied at least once a week.
Wow.
A quarter of working Americans, and this is not old data, this is 2026 data, 25% say I feel bullied at least once a week. So we've got to unpack that in organizations. We have to understand, well, what does that mean? When you say you feel bullied, what does that look like? What's okay? What's not okay in this organization? Because without psychological safety, it's impossible to bring joy into that kind of an environment.
Okay, from that point of view, if you're the leader of a company and you're listening to this right now, it's not only the worker bees who are experiencing stress. Often there's even more stress put upon the people who have a lot of responsibility for their employees. What would you recommend is a step that they can take to not only help their own stress, but help the culture that might be supporting bullying or stress in their workplace?
I think the first thing they need to do is start the conversation. And many times when I work in organizations, that's the value that I bring, is just creating the space to have the conversation, to start normalizing what is the amount of stress that we're feeling here. One of the types of stress is system stress, and that's where bullying would fit in. This idea that the very system that I am in is making it harder for me to do my job. So whether you're leading a team or an entire organization or even leading yourself, I think that first step of let's have the conversation about what it is we're experiencing is always the right place to start.
Yeah. I am dying to know, Amy, you're very open about your personal experience. You've already talked about the worst boss ever, but you talk about having 100 stress-induced panic attacks in 3 months. It led to medical leave. It led to this big realization. It led to what you're doing now. I think some people have stress-induced panic attacks without even really realizing that they're having them.
It was the most terrifying moment of my life. And I think unless you've had one, it's almost impossible to understand what it feels like. And once you've had one, to talk to someone else who's had one, it's like, oh, finally someone gets it. So what it felt like for me was I assumed I was having a heart attack. My heart was racing. I was dizzy. I was sweating. I mean, all the things that I had read, this is what a heart attack feels like. And so to then be told, no, you're not having a heart attack, that was great news. Like, okay, wonderful. But then the bad news was when he said, this is likely a panic attack. And just as you said, it wasn't just that one. It started in early summer. And by early fall, I was at over 100 of them. And it's the part of the book that I'm the most proud of, because when I wrote the draft, I said what you just said, I had over 100. And each time I started to edit, I would make it a little softer. I had dozens, I had some. And then by the last draft, I didn't include it at all. And so now I was in the final edit. And anyone who's ever written a book knows there's that edit where the editor says, this is it, this is your last shot. And I'm even getting goosebumps as I talk about it. So I went back in and I put the sentence back because I was worried about feeling ashamed or embarrassed or all the things we feel when there's mental health. But those panic attacks were part of my story, and they were part of my healing story too. And so if you've ever had one, you are not alone, and to just get the support that you need to find a way forward.
That reminds me of so long ago, maybe 12 years ago, we spoke to Dan Harris, who was a journalist, and he had a panic attack on air on national news. Remember that? And he ended up writing a book called 10% Happier. And I watched the video of him and I didn't know. I said, oh, I wouldn't have known that you were having a panic attack. He said, that's because you've never had one before, obviously. And so it's really hard to have empathy, but it's so, so important. Thank you so much for sharing that story with us. And congratulations that you found your way through to a whole other world.
Thank you. And I appreciate Dan's story. I've watched that video so many times because you do see it. When you know what to look for, you do see it. But there have been thousands of people in my life who missed it. I've had them while lecturing in graduate school. I've had them while on the air. I've had them while, I mean, you just don't know what you're looking for if you don't know. So thank you for reminding me of Dan. I think his courage and vulnerability I feel inspired by it to this day.
Well, in hopes of none of us needing to have panic attacks about the stress in our workplaces, we've been speaking with Amy Leneker, author of a great new book called Cheers to Monday, The Surprisingly Simple Method to Lead and Live with Less Stress and More Joy. Amy, it's been a pleasure to speak with you, and I think we've gotten some really good strategies, so thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I'll come back anytime. I love this.
We look forward to it.